Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
You're listening to All of It on WNYC. Welcome back. The 73rd Tony Awards will be broadcast this coming Sunday, June 9th, on CBS. Many of the nominees have stopped by the All of It studios this past year for conversations about their shows and their work. We're bringing you excerpts of those conversations this week as we look ahead to the show. The next conversation is with the creative team behind the smash hit musical Hadestown, which leads the Tony pack with 14 nominations, including Best Musical, Best Original Score and Best Book of a Musical for Anais Mitchell, Best Direction of a Musical for Rachel Chafkin, and Best Featured Actor in a Musical for Andre DeShields. Hadestown was 13 years in the making and opened on Broadway just in April. It began more than a decade ago as a few lyrics and a melody in Anais Mitchell's head, and it became an album that gained a cult following. That grew into an off-Broadway production, which blossomed into a Broadway musical with reviews that use words like sumptuous, sexy, and spectacular. And as one reviewer said, going to hell has never been as much fun as seeing a performance of Anais Mitchell's musical Hadestown. The story is based on the myth of Orpheus and Eurydice, the ancient story of the poet who descends to the underworld to retrieve the soul of his dead lover. Hades, king of the underworld, allows it with a condition. It's a test, really. Orpheus has to walk out of the underworld while his wife follows, and if he looks behind him, she returns to the land of the dead for good. Guiding the young lovers and us, the audience, is the narrator who is smooth and has swagger for days. He is Hermes, and he's played by theater legend Andre DeShields. I talked to Anais, Rachel, and Andre, and began by asking Anais about Hadestown's origin story. Take a listen.
A lot of times if I'm writing a song, like just a phrase will come into my head, and usually it has just a few words and a melody. And in this case, it contained the seed of what became that song, Wait For Me. And it had some other words. Wait for me, I'm coming in my garters and pearls. With what melody did you barter me from the wicked underworld? And those lyrics never made it into any version of the show, but they sort of pointed to the Eurydice story. So anyway, I was in my 20s. I was living in the state of Vermont. And I had a bunch of creative friends up there. The early director of the show was named Ben Matchstick. He came from the bread and puppet world. And two of my collaborators that I've been working with basically since that time, Michael Chorney and Todd Sikafoos, are the arranger orchestrators of the piece Still. And Michael started working in 2006 and Todd in 2007. We put on the show as a DIY community theater project in Vermont. We played like town halls and music venues, and we traveled around in a school bus that was painted silver.
That's cool.
Yeah, it was a much more abstract version of the show than what is happening now. But it was magical in its way. And then a couple years later, I started working on with Todd Sikafoos working on this studio record, which had guest singers singing the different roles of the characters. And then the piece kind of moved into the music world. So we would tour around Michael Chorney and a six-piece band and me and guest singers in different towns and cities. And for a few years, we just presented the show as a concert. But I had always wanted to develop it further and see it on stage again. And in 2012, I met Rachel because I saw The Great Comet at Ars Nova and totally was just blown away by it. Rachel's direction in particular. And we had a mutual friend, this drummer named Ray, who gave me her number, and I reached out, and we started talking about the show. And 6 years later, here we are. We've done like many, many workshops. We did off Broadway. We went to Edmonton, Canada, and then London, and then here we are on Broadway just now.
So my producer, Simon, who you met earlier, he studied classics in college. He got way deep into the myths with me, like going through all of them. Were you always enamored with myths? I mean, this could have been a boy meets girl, anybody's story, but you went for these sort of these classic stories.
I know. You know, it's not like I studied mythology or anything. I'm not sort of a classics buff. But I do remember encountering this particular myth in a children's illustrated mythology book, the Dolores.
Oh,
I think that's how you say it. Yeah. And there was just a very compelling illustration of the ascent of the lovers out of the underworld. And this story has been retold so many times in so many beautiful ways, especially by musicians, because they have this hero musician character. And I loved Black Orpheus, and I loved the Cocteau movie, L'Orfeu. And yeah, all of those things were inspiring in terms of this particular story.
Andre, when you first heard the music and read the book of this musical, what did you think?
This is what I thought when I first heard the music and read the book, that I need to introduce a factoid, to the telling of this story, because I'm proud of it, and I want everybody to know how close I am to Aeneas. Also in 2012, when Aeneas was meeting the great Chafkin, I believe the first theatrical iteration of Hadestown was done in the studios of Second Stage, in which I had my opportunity to inject my DNA to Hermes. So I want to claim to be the prototype Hermes, okay? So not only did I inject my DNA into Hermes, I also put a boomerang in there so that somewhere along this journey, it would come back to me. Mm-hmm. It took 6 years.
But
it came back to me. Now, to specifically respond to your question, I hear the music, I read the script, and it touches me in the three parts of my being that have established my mantra, which is to speak beautifully, to walk beautifully, to live beautifully. And that's what Hermes allows me to do in this beautiful context of ancient pagan ritual, which supplies us in almost in every beautiful line of Aeneas' poetry, some contemporary reflection from which we can learn a life lesson.
Mm. Ah. One of my dancer friends was, she just was obsessing about how you walk down the stairs. She was like, I'm going to hold on to that forever. Just singing about walking beautifully. Yeah.
So Rachel, as a director, you get a hold of the script and this music. It seems like there's just so much opportunity here. What is it that you wanted to bring out? What did you think needed to come to the forefront so that we, the audience, are in from the beginning?
Yeah, I mean, so I did encounter the studio album first and foremost when Aeneas and I started kind of getting to know each other in 2012, 2013. And actually, we started not so much... I did bring one particular visual to Aeneas, which was this idea of the swinging lamps. Mm. That was like the first image that I ever had. And when later you told me the story of that song coming to you while driving, I was like, oh, of course, I was seeing the street lamps pass over your windshield as you're like going to your love. So that felt really, we use this word a lot, but like cosmic. Mm-hmm. But actually we spent years mostly talking about story. There was a libretto at that time that we looked at, but more than anything, we actually spent time with the studio album that was sort of this record of the original theater work that had begun to happen in Vermont. And we talked through what was like being achieved with each song and what characters already felt present and who I felt like I was tracking. And more than anything, being an audience member and going, well, this is what I've learned. Where did Persephone go between these five songs? Okay, well, that feels like it's to be filled in. And so very slowly, Aeneas was writing and writing and writing more and then at a certain point revising to kind of fill in that story architecture. So that was the big thing that I was looking at.
One of the reviews that's been interesting, it said it went from cool to gorgeous.
Yeah.
Off-Broadway it was cool, and on Broadway it's gorgeous. What changed?
A lot of things changed. I mean, certainly if I think about those two words specifically, like downtown, the show was still very much in process. And so a lot of the storytelling was done at microphones. There was still a huge nod to sort of the concert background, the fact that the piece was still very much rooted as a music event, first and foremost, and not a dramatic event in the sense of like live action happening in space. So one of the significant things that happened is we got rid of those microphones. They became, you know, lavs on the actors' faces, other than Hermes's, you know, storytelling mic, the beautiful two-headed mic. And the staging got, you know, larger. And so as Orpheus journeys down into the underworld, you feel a sense of physical journey as a result, and the physical production to match. But the other huge thing that happened is thematically and writing-wise, the show just got like 20 stories deeper. And a big part of that was, I think, the addition of the workers' chorus, which we had begun thinking, like knowing that we wanted in the future at New York Theatre Workshop, but couldn't afford it and wouldn't have had anywhere to put them anyway in the little space. But we added the workers' chorus in Canada, and then they really grew into themselves as an entity, as a character in London and now on Broadway. And that was both the addition of this like extraordinary group of actor, singer, performer, dancers who just like enrich the theater of the piece so much, but also, and I think more importantly, it was always clear what Orpheus's walk meant for Eurydice and for him, because it meant, you know, getting each other's love back in the world. But this piece has always had political undertones of Hadestown as this oppressive state. And so what wasn't clear was the consequences of Orpheus's walk and just daring to ask Hades, can we go? And so that simple question of just asking power,
can we be
for
free?
A change? Mm-hmm. Yeah, can we have this freedom? That the ramifications of that really only began to become clear in the show once we added those workers.
My guests are Rachel Chavkin, Anais Mitchell, and Andre DeShields. The addition of Hermes as our narrator, I mean, that's not anywhere in the myths. Why did you feel like we needed Hermes?
Yeah. Well, as Rachel was saying, you know, this is my process with Rachel has been a very loving and aggressive and deep dramaturg on this show for 6 years, you know, and especially because I come from the music world, mm-hmm. I come from songwriting world, and Rachel comes from theater. And it's like, I think at New York Theatre Workshop, we were asking a lot of patience of people, like, hey, let's just be okay with it. This is going to be a 3.5-minute song, and there may or may not be an event or a result, you know, we're just going to hang out in it. And then trying to just bring the piece further and further towards what feels like generous storytelling. And the Hermes character as a narrator is a really, has been a really important part of that. And I loved, Andre, what I heard you say the other day about something about Hermes coming out there at the beginning of the show and making almost like a contract with the audience.
The contract that Hermes is establishing with the audience after he says,
Night.
Yeah.
Is this. Join us on this journey. Mm-hmm. You may be challenged. You may even be changed. But you will not be harmed. Mm-hmm. And their response is a joyous,
Even though you let us know this is a sad song and we're going to tell it again.
Yeah, but that's when we learn our lessons about how to live a joyous life by listening to sad songs, mm-hmm. listening to sad poetry, going through the Rolodex of our mind of the most sad experiences we've ever had, and then making that right. Mm-hmm.
I saw you in The Wiz when I was 10.
Uh-oh.
Yes. I saw Nate Misbehaving.
Yes.
Uh-oh. Did you see me in The Full Monty?
I don't know.
Okay.
Without that one.
Well, then you haven't seen
it. Okay, I haven't seen it. But I have admired you. In fact, it's funny. I just, when you walked in, somebody in the newsroom tweeted like, oh my God, The Wiz just walked by. Yes.
But it's lovely, you know. In The Wiz, I was called Mr. Wiz. And now,
Mr.
in
Hermes.
Hadestown, I'm called Mr. Hermes. Hermes. I'm loving these appellations. Huh. Yeah.
I'm interested in what you think, as someone who's been around Broadway for a long time, about this move towards you know, race-blind casting. We've got your lead, Eva, right? She's half Filipino and half Mexican. Amber Gray is biracial. The Fates are a little bit of something for everybody. I'm curious, A, as someone who's been in this business for a long time and you've seen it go the other way for a long time, how you feel about it, and how do you think it's going to change theater going forward?
First of all, long time. I am celebrating a half century in the theater.
My first
professional show was 1969. So that's another important golden step in my journey that's associated with Hadestown.
Maybe that suit needs to be gold instead of silver.
No. The suit is silver, right? The bust was silver. Huh. But my party costume for opening night was gold.
Yes.
Excellent.
The only two colors of the gods. I don't believe in this idea of race blind casting.
Yeah.
You have to be absolutely aware of race and ethnicity and culture and gender, all of the important things that make us who we are, in order to make the menu as comprehensive as it is in Hadestown. Now, I believe that theater must reflect the world in which we live. So if you walk the streets of New York, any street of New York, you are seeing the world in all of its glory, in all of its coolness, in all of its contradictions. And as performers and auteurs and writers and poets, etc., it is our responsibility to make sure that if not everybody, most of everybody is universally reflected in the art that we create. Otherwise, we can't tell a true story. Mm-hmm. And it is Hermes' responsibility to tell not only a story, but the truest story that he can. And he does that because in this contract that he's made with the audience, the audience doesn't articulate it this way, but they come to the theater because they don't have a temple to go to. And that's where strangers gather. To do what? To have a question answered? To have a problem solved? To have a crisis resolved? To have a burden lifted? To have a yoke broken? Now, I know that's highfalutin words, but that's why the people come and experience the three major cardinal gifts of the theater: entertainment, enlightenment, and ecstasy. And that's what Hadestown is heavy in. Ecstasy.
One of the things I love is that the band is on stage.
Sure.
Orchestra. Shout out to Marika Hughes.
Oh, yeah. Beautiful.
She spotted me on the street and pointed at me, so I know she listened to the show. Hi, Marika.
Yes. And our whole band actually transferred from downtown to uptown.
And shout out to Michael.
Yeah, Michael Turney.
Who plays the guitar in the band.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What does that do for a production? Because in The Great Comet, a lot of the music was on stage. Josh is playing the piano and there were the accordions. What does that do for a production?
Yeah, I think I don't want to speak for David Newman, our choreographer, but one of the things he and I talk a lot about is capturing every shred of this glorious music in the physical in some way. And so certainly there are lines from Marika's cello that are in how one of the dancers is moving their shoulder. And I think that happens all the more so when you can actually see the musicians making the music. I mean, it's anathema to me to ever think about not being able to have access, visual access to the music that's happening, because that's one of the glories of the live event, is that all of these artists are present making this work happen. So there's some complexities about sound and putting dear Ben Porowski into a soundproof hut. But I can't imagine not seeing them.
My guests are Andre DeShields, Rachel Chavkin, and Anais Mitchell. We're talking about Hadestown, which is currently on Broadway. I do want to talk about the song The Wall, because it's so interesting. So there's this song that Hades sings. It's interesting on a couple levels. One is because you wrote it a decade ago.
Right.
And it's for everybody who went Wall and thought politics right away. I mean, it does have a political undertone to it, but this song was written 10 years ago. Hayes is singing it, and he's talking about keeping poverty out because to keep us safe. So let's play a little bit of the song, and then we'll talk about it on the other side.
How does the wall keep us free? My children, how does the wall keep us free?
So Aeneas, you wrote that 10 years ago. Given what's going on politically today, was there any discussion about changing that song or shifting the way it's presented?
Huh. No, I don't remember ever having a conversation about that. But I do think, you know, when that song started to feel relevant the way that it has, and I think when we were doing the show off-Broadway was during the campaign.
That's right.
And so we were hearing that language. Yeah,
like
a lot
of these.
Over
the course of the run, he became the nominee.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. And hearing it in a sort of rally style, call and response style chant, you know, which is the way it's staged in the show. I do remember wondering if I was supposed to be tailoring the rest of the show to kind of meet the moment, and then at a certain point saying, no, you know, it's mm-hmm. a myth, it's thousands of years old, and the world tailors itself to those myths and not the other way around.
What did you think, Rachel, as it was happening?
Yeah, I mean,
developing?
Totally horror. You know, walls are really old. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, they're just as old as the myth and the idea of a person in power who maintains their power by keeping people afraid and keeping people divided. Hermes has a line in the show, divide and conquer is what it's called. And that is the metaphor for Orpheus and Eurydice's walk out of hell or out of Hadestown. Mm-hmm. And it's also the metaphor for the wall and that sense of if you keep us divided, you can conquer. And that it's through solidarity, whether that's with your lover or your fellow human, that change becomes possible. So there was never any thought. I mean, I think if anything, there was care about not overly literalizing mm-hmm. because it was always a bigger image than our president. You know, mm-hmm. he can't have all the air. Mm-hmm. And we never wanted to give him any part of this production. So that the world is present in that song, but it's not about, the staging was never about like nodding to him in
right,
any way.
Right.
As you think about the show, each of you, what's your favorite part? I know it's a little bit of a softball question, but I'm really curious because there's so much going on.
I got a favorite part.
Yeah.
When Eva Noblezada, there's another name for you.
Noblezada. Got it.
Sings Flowers. Mm-hmm. And Aeneas helped me with the first few lines. All I wanted was to fall asleep, to close my eyes and disappear.
Yeah.
Like a pebble in a stream.
A petal.
Petal. Petal in a stream.
A feather on the air.
Okay. Now, as Hermes, I have to, and I must, and I enjoy listening to the show. There are long stretches of where I am in a desert of ether, all the smoke and the fog and the condensation. And those smoke pictures that I have to look at help me to re-enter the storytelling and explain what you've just seen or heard mm-hmm. or what you're about to see and here. When Eva sings that song, because everything that happens in the ancient world is reflected in the contemporary world, I think about the opioid epidemic we're going through now, and I think, those people wouldn't articulate it this way, but anyone who's strung out on opiates are saying, all I wanted was to fall asleep, to close mm-hmm. my eyes, to disappear. Just for a moment. And then that brings into great relief in Hermes' mind the best examples of that. Michael Jackson and Prince. You imagine, that's all they wanted. It was just a moment to disappear.
Moment of peace.
Mm. Yeah. So there's so many layers that I would love to be able to say, audience, check this out. But it's impossible. But at that moment when Eva sings that song, the two worlds conflate for me. They become mirrors of each other. As the stage, the physical stage, one of the reasons why the show works so perfectly in the Walter Kerr Theater, the stage reflects the audience.
Yeah, everybody's in. Everybody's in. Yeah. Do you have a favorite part real quick?
Yeah, am I allowed to say two? There, and one is a reprise of the other one. So it's the Wait for Me's, you know. It's both of the Wait for Me's. And so much of that has to do with this glorious staging, just visual mind over here. And but I don't want to give it away because I want people to come see the show. But there's some crazy things that happen.
Give it away, they'll come see the show.
Yeah, there's lights, there's lamps, there's smoke, there's the singing of a song that
and
breaks
Reeves,
the world.
Reeves, like, perfect voice cutting through
there's
all of
Reeves
that,
There's Reeves' perfect voice on Wait For Me 1, and there's Eva's perfect voice on Wait For
Me
2.
Yeah. And that's the other moment, right, at the end of Wait For Me 2, where there's a moment of just pure, you know, release before we go into the depths of the doubt that comes into Orpheus's mind. And there's a funny moment where people, we haven't set it up so that people have a spot to applaud, but they do it anyway because Eva just throws down so hard in that moment. It's always exhilarating.
Totally.
My guests have been Andre DeShields, Rachel Chavkin, and Anais Mitchell. The name of the show is Hades Downs. Congratulations on all the success.
Thank you so much.
And thanks
much.
For coming to the studio.
Thanks yes,
for
indeed.
Having us.
Wild horses couldn't have kept us away.
This is All of It on WNYC.
And spill a drop for Orpheus, wherever he is now. Some birds sing when the sun shines bright. My praise is not for them, but the one who sings in the dead of night. I raise my